from the Hill Country of Texas, this is One Radio Network.
Yeah, and we're going to have somebody on from the Mulberry Institute next Tuesday to talk about succession. Because
beautiful.
I just can't wait till states start to bail out of this crazy.
Me neither. I'm doing what I can to get that message out, you know. And Kirkpatrick Sale is going to be coming on,
he's the fellow that's going to be on next week. Yeah, Mr. Sale.
Right, well, that's great. We're going to have him on Swedish radio soon. We're setting up to get Kirkpatrick on to Swedish radio and, definitely help him get the word out about this, because that's I've always talked all through my, public career on the legal means of turning the ship of state around, you know, so this is a tremendous study these guys are doing, yeah.
We do a show once a week on the Constitution and freedom, and we've had Ron Paul on, Mr. Tsarian, and we're trying to talk Ron Paul into running for governor of Texas in 2010 so we could bail out of this union. And I don't know, if we get enough people, he may just grab onto that idea.
Yeah, it's about enough people, and it can happen. It definitely can happen. And I'm thrilled to hear that you're doing that, because that's so, so important. And I'd really love to get a copy of the interview that you do with Kirkpatrick.
I'll send it over. And, you know, if we did this, 250 years ago and broke away from the British, we could do it again. And somebody told me they only had like 12% of the people were into the revolution, and we pulled that one off.
3%.
Oh, was it 3%?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it is. It's not a matter of will it happen. It is going to happen. There's only either two choices. You have Global Village and this whole New World Order stuff that's ruled by exactly the same henchmen that have always, you know, that we broke away from before in America.
The same people.
Same people. I mean, people from Northern Ireland, you know, helped in the War of Independence, fighting on the American side.
Right.
Many Germans did. You know, the Scots-Irish did. So, again, it's like somebody like Thomas Jefferson said, you know, you have to refight the Wars of Independence again. You know, America's famous for losing the wars it wins. Now you got to really win the war, you know, again, and that's okay. That's perfectly all right, you know. A tyrant is a tyrant, just in the same way that a vulture is a vulture, and they do need to be culled. They need to be told that you may think you have the power, but you do not have the power. You may have the control, but you do not have the power. The people have the power, and an educated group of people have the best kind of power.
And what's your first name? Where are you calling from? You're on the air.
Oh, hi. My name is Lorraine, and I'm calling from Vancouver, B.C.
Hi.
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 How are you?
We're good, thank you.
Good. Are you talking with Michael Tsari right now?
You are.
Oh, I am.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
That's great. I had a question for you, Michael, or actually I had a kind of like just a comment as well about permaculture and all. But I was really frustrated about the way things are going, and I thought, how am I going to fight back of it? And fight back. And the thing that I was getting myself really concerned about was Codex Alimentarius and the Federal Reserve. And I kind of discovered all that in the last, you know, I'd say the last year. And although I was, you know, quite aware of other things going on, I never really understood what the Fed was all about until I discovered that. And then I thought, you know, how do you fight back? Like, how do you get people to wake up? Because I'm a really sensitive person. Have been forever, and I'm delighted that you're there, that I can tell you that I'm a 18-9 or a moon hermit, and I've really discovered more and more what that truly means, and so it makes me that extra sensitive type person, but what I decided to do was get into permaculture and raw food, so that's what I'm currently studying right now. And I'm really excited about it because everybody that I'm coming into contact with, as much as I can, I'm talking about permaculture, how you have to start sustaining your life and, the hard times that are coming. And I'm with you when as far as, people are quite aware of it, at least the people that I am coming across. Maybe it's because I'm surrounding myself in that kind of arena of permaculture and raw food, but definitely I'm just speaking out to people. I'm letting them know what it is that I know, hooking them up with websites that are like yours and Patrick's and any kind of video or whatever. I am always just streaming it on to other people so they could just wake up. In fact, you know, it's so funny because sometimes I'm so much more compassionate than even some of the Americans that I see. And I'm Canadian, and I here I am writing to, you know, people that are American and saying, hey, like, listen to this and watch this and so forth. So,
well, you're doing a good job, sweetie. You just keep going, and you're going to keep running into more people, huh, Michael? She'll keep finding more people.
Oh, yeah, it's getting bigger all the time, and that's what people need to do. They need to stay active, use the tools that you have, but it also must be from your knowledge. Shooting the breeze is not going to cut it anymore. So what you're doing, Lorraine, is really good, because that is about, you know, you're doing the homework first, you're doing the studies first, and then you move from that place to, you know, extend it to those who are receptive. But, you know, my message to people like yourself is never waste your energy or burn your cylinders out, wasting time on those who are not going to get it, because there's many people out there to reach on a global level. So even if on the local yokel level, and this message doesn't just go to you, Lorraine, it goes to anyone who's listening here. Too many people email me and get in contact with me about, oh my God, I feel like I'm Genghis Khan. Nobody listens to me. I'm totally alienated. I waste all my time telling these people. And of course, what they mean is that they're talking about the local yokels that they meet, you know, or the girlfriend or some other nonsense like that. And my message is, listen, this is a huge subject that is so tied into who we are spiritually. You know, whoever gave you the idea that, you know, the people in your local community or around you are really going to be that interested? This is a global message. It's a global subject for a global audience. And now through the internet, through radio, and through various other means, you see, television, cable access, writing, you know, a book form, whatever, you know, the people are there, but they're scattered all over the world in this sort of diverse way. So, again, to limit people's frustration, realize that, look, if you're not immediately met with a bunch of trumpet fanfare about what you're into, don't despair. It comes because it's the nature of the subject that you're studying. It's a tremendously controversial and very fringe and very deep, in a way, subject. It's not going to be for everyone. And in your local area, you may be lucky to even find just even a handful of sincere people who are into what you're doing. But that shouldn't mean that you stop. You just realize, listen, I'll just take it to the next level.
Just go to somebody else. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, go, yeah. Keep moving, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, you know, I don't take it lightly myself. Like, I really treasure, you know, the life that I have. And the funny thing is that the more I investigate this, it's like the more I find out things about, who I am as a spiritual individual, like coming across, you know, knowing that, you know, I've discovered that I'm a hermit moon and that I'm a triple Taurus, that I'm a cosmic blue storm, and all of these things, you know, can explain to me why is it that I'm so passionate or so driven or so, like, sensitive and, like, just, you know, I just got to do something.
And there you go.
And it's, you know, you can't write off those things because symbolically, if you could relate to it, and it seems to me it was easy for me to relate to it, you know, it's just just another driving force. It's the confidence that it gives you to say, hey, yeah, you know what, I am real and I am right and it feels good, and just go for it regardless.
There you go. And Lorraine, don't forget now, every Wednesday we have our show on the Federal Reserve with Andrew Goss, The Real World of Money. You said you were a student of that every Wednesday, and this guy really knows his stuff about the Fed. We were actually talking, Michael, about Eustace Mullins last night, because he was a mentor of Andrew Goss, and we can't seem to find dear Eustace, and we hope that he's well. I had the pleasure of interviewing him many years ago, but it's hard to be found right now. Here's an email from Wayne. Great show. Thank you. I'm enjoying it. Is Michael familiar with the writings of Wallace Wattles? Wallace Wattles.
No, that doesn't sound familiar, actually.
Never heard.
Does it say what?
No, he doesn't say. But it is. I've never heard that one.
But the one comment about what Lorraine was saying there about her astrology and the divination arts, it's, again, I would really amplify that one of the great studies of life, remember, because we've always been talking here about how anything that we're doing socially is really sort of an extension of who we are spiritually, and it's a feedback loop.
Uh-huh.
You know, the divination arts and learning at our, looking at our astrology is very much a help. It's an assistant. It's like looking into a mirror that then tells us more about ourselves, you know, and our complexion. It's also a key part of all of this to help build up the psychic immunity. Because remember, the psychically unimmune person who hasn't the faintest idea who he is, where he's come from, and where he's going, is hardly going to be in a position to help himself or anybody else. This whole thing starts with discovering who we are as individuals, again, bringing out our own individual capacities and moving from that place so that our foundation is very, very strong. We're doing what we're doing because it's written in our stars, so to speak. This is also very important because, again, we addressed this in the latest DVD, is that too many people who are into this subject are merely intellectual. They just want to grasp this kind of information because it's like cool or trendy now.
Yes, sir.
You know, there's a lot of bandwagon hopping, and there's a lack of sincerity, and then they're into this, they're into that, they're into this, they're like butterflies. Or you have another group who become fanatically fixated on one particular teacher or one particular little clique, and then they don't move for about 50 years. You know, they become totally fossilized, which has, again, happened even outside this particular area of study. But you see, so there's lots of pitfalls. And again, what I see in that is that these individuals are not really sincere. They've lost the truth that it is connected to our spiritual destiny, and that no man who is not dealing with his inner house first has a hope in hell of changing, you know, anything in the social milieu. He might just muddy the waters. He may egoistically think that he's doing a great deal. But as a matter of fact, you know, his work is going to really come to nothing unless he's already aware of how this impinges his own spiritual inner, you know, development.
Mm, very well said. You know, one thing I'd like to say that might help our listeners too, as we reach out there, Mr. Tesarian and listeners, is that I've found over the years, the many years of looking spiritually of who I am, you know, because I just keep asking, what am I doing here? Who am I? And I've had glimpses of some past lives, and I've really experienced reincarnation. So for me, it's a truth and not just a belief. And by doing that, it's really helped me to understand for Patrick, now I'm just speaking for myself, that I've created all the good guys and the bad guys and the people in between. And when I began to understand that, it really helped me to let go of any anger and frustration that I had, for example, for the government and for other people. And because it was kind of my karma, you know, and it really helped me to understand that it was okay. I wasn't going to let them take advantage of me anymore, but at least I could let go of the anger. And when I let go of the anger, it really helped me to do more research and read your kind of books, and without getting flipped out.
Oh, it's so important. It's so important.
It really is important, isn't it?
Yeah. This might start as a kind of a hobby for people. But what I'm seeing since 9/11, you see, is it's not been like that. What I'm seeing is an enormous passion from the new people coming in. This is what is really inspiring to me. It doesn't mean they're right. It doesn't mean that they're not going to get waylaid or confused. But what I am seeing is that there has been a lot of passion. I've seen this physically at the conferences that I've done.
Uh-huh.
I get, you know, 200 odd emails a day, you know, plus the forum comments on my forum, you know. So it's absolutely factual that the people are hungry for this information. And what also starts to develop over time, of course, and people shouldn't beat themselves up if they don't have it in the beginning, is that discernment. Discernment about what is false and what is true will come. What I've been getting, especially in the last year, I've been noticing, is a lot of newbies and a lot of, you know, bandwagon jumpers and a lot of internet assassin types and people who are terribly insincere about this information, terribly misinformed.
Hmm.
And then what they're doing is that they're imagining that they now have a PhD in discernment.
I see. Very interesting.
And that they're the last judge and jury of who is, you know, right and who's wrong. I mean, you may have that for some, you know, like the movie Punisher or some other sitcom,
right,
some other Hollywood crazy, you know, movie in which you just go around massacring, you know, the people who you think are wrong. But, you know, that works in fiction. It doesn't work in the subjects that are as sacred as these, to be telling, you know, pointing the fingers and pretending that you're the last port of call,
sure,
you know, as to what is true. That's born out of insecurity. It's born out of terrible, terrible fear. You know, I call it the deer caught in the headlights of the uncommon truth movement. This is scary to a lot of people. And this is also one of the reasons which puts a lot of people off, is because when the light is coming down, you know, at breakneck speed as it is now coming down the path for the human race, that is very, very scary to a lot of people who don't want to be found out and who are terribly threatened by that kind of movement, you know.
Boy, the information's really flying in, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes I just have to keep breathing here. I wanted to ask you about the your ideas about our origins. I'm a real student of health and nutrition. We do lots and lots of shows, Mr. Tesorian, on health and nutrition, trying to figure out a right diet. And it's a moving target for most people, as you well know. Yeah. And I'm wondering, do you have any insights on how this body of ours has possibly evolved? You know, I get the feeling, I don't know why, that there was some kind of intervention somewhere along the line. Do you have any insights into that where possibly some people other than planet Earth hasn't been involved with manipulating this thing we call the body?
Well, yes. This goes along with my theories on Atlantis. As I continued studying what the Irish records were saying, and it got me into some of the stuff in South America, it got me deeper into even things of the Sumerian record and certainly other lands, it started to look as if something bizarre had taken place. Originally, when we start talking, you asked about dates. You said, you know, when did
these... Oh, yeah, when Atlantis, right.
Yeah, happened. And, of course, there's two major dates that stand out. And so it could be... These are two major dates. One is about 50,000 years ago.
50?
Some kind of amazing cataclysm took place, which could have been a sign that, you know, there was something going on then. It's hard to know. And then more recently, about 13,000 or 13,500 years ago, there was another major event. And in between those two events were other mini events. And then after 13,000 years ago, there have been a bunch of other catastrophes that have been slightly less, you know, dramatic. But at two points in the fossil record, we see that about 50,000 years ago, there was some sort of cosmic devastation that affected the Earth terribly.
Huh.
And then again, the 13,000 years. So people can take their pick. I've worked with both dates, and I've tried to, you know, work with both dates. But again, nobody can be totally sure. And I would say that certainly the death of Atlantis, certainly the Atlantean period, or let's say that more correctly, the pre-Diluvian period, seems to have finally passed out of existence about 13,000 years ago. So even if it existed, its last days, its dying death throes, appear to be, you know, around about 13,000 years ago. And then very shortly after that, you see, now it's accepted that about 11,000 years ago from today is when the so-called historical era opens, when we have the rise of the various, you know, empires that are familiar more in a historical kind
mm-hmm.
of way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go back, one of the interesting things is when you look at even some of the old cylinder seals, when you read the mythologies, you are hearing not just about the War of the Gods, you're not just hearing about the presence of super technologies. You're not just hearing about magical mental powers and abilities. You know, you're also hearing about some form of genetic manipulation. We would understand it now. You know, through the hundreds of years, people would have never used the term genetic. So remember, we were talking in the beginning about this era being special for us.
Yes.
It's because we have rediscovered some of the super technologies, you see, that were being used in the ancient days so that we can understand now when we go back and read the myths and we see descriptions of cryogenic chambers or cybernetics and we see information about super weaponry and when we see information in the Mahabharata and in the Irish legends, you see, about this tampering with the DNA and the chromosomes, we can understand it now. Our forefathers didn't because they didn't have the technology before the Industrial Age.
So the reason it's in our awareness because maybe it's happened before.
It did happen before, yeah. And this has been even corroborated by people like Robert Oppenheimer, you know, who when asked about whether the atomic bomb at Hiroshima was the first one to be dropped, or the one at Alamogordo was the first one to be dropped, what does he say? He goes, well, yes, in modern times, of course. Hang on a minute. What? You know, that these insiders know something we don't know? Yeah, you bet they do. They know that in the Mahabharata and the unedited Vedas, there it is. There's the information about the flying ships, the flying crafts, the War of the Gods, the terrible upheaval, the Age of Cataclysm. So with this genetic manipulation, I believe there was a primal trauma.
Trauma?
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, tinkering around with any part of your biology is going to traumatize.
It's pretty traumatic.
Well, think about that on a genetic level. When you have literally crossed a foreign off-world DNA with a human DNA, believe me, that is no fun. That's not just cloning some kind of sheep. This is a heavy-duty transgenic experimentation that I believe is the origin of evil. That is where what we would call evil injustice came from. It's from this cocktail of biology. That was then exacerbated by the earth changes and the great traumas that took place And I also believe because of the alien presence in the world, there was a war, a great, tremendous war that the Mahabharata and other legends talk about. So there was two waves of trauma. Both, each wave was enough to destroy our forefathers mentally, make them into basically pathological schizophrenic creatures. But taken together, both of them, following one on from the other, we did survive. Amazingly, we survived. And my work goes into how we survived, why we survived. But we survived as bicameral creatures. We had a divided psyche.
What's that word you use? Bicameral, divided brain kind of thing?
Yeah, uh-huh. Exactly. Divided brain. Mm. We're basically schizoid. We're schizophrenic people.
Well,
we're fragmented.
We all knew that, right?
Yep. We were fragmented in our consciousness. We're fragmented in our emotional, circuitry. And basically the ego, what we now know as the ego, which we wake up every morning and we have this thing called ego consciousness. Mm-hmm. Ego consciousness is this ambivalent friend that we have that's really part tyrant, part savior.
Yeah.
So we're left with the remnants of two massive kinds of trauma that have happened in relatively recent times. And to answer your question, yep, I believe we were genetically interfered with. I think the evidence is overwhelming for that.
And you think it was in that 11,000 BC area?
Terminated then. There's been a long centuries, maybe even millennia, in which these genetic programs took place. Because we have little evidence, when I say with one breath, a lot of evidence, of course, I'm talking about a lot of evidence coming out of the little evidence that the royal societies and the royal academies have allowed us to look at. So, the evidence is there, and it's substantial. But, of course, it would be a lot more evidence if we had a disclosure, if we didn't have these various bodies, sequestering this information. But out of this information also comes the fact that this particular manipulation of our forefathers, both Cro-Magnon and the Neanderthals, was over a long period of time. It wasn't something that just happened within, a few decades or a few centuries. It took its own sweet time, and there's possibility that it even went on for millennia.
Do you think then we are an experiment of some kind, and then these same people that did it could perhaps still be around and trying to look at us and see what we're doing here? Or what would be the purpose of that? What would be the motive behind that?
Oh, well, the motive for the original interference was that the visitors needed slaves. They needed workers. They were desperate. In one way, you can't blame them. I mean, I do blame them, but in one way, just imagine for a moment that we're very, very accepting. We can understand that these individuals who came here needed the assistance. They needed to have a workforce that would work the planet for them.
We're working it for them, aren't we?
Yeah, right. Now, but to be specific about what you're asking, and I get this asked a lot, is it's not quite right to say that there's an us and them in that context.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that this alien strain remains in a pure alien form. What has happened is the genetic manipulation also involved that each human being that's alive today, I don't rule out that there may be something else, but I found no evidence of it. All I can say is that all human beings, even the controllers, are both a mixture of the alien DNA and the human DNA. So it's not about that there's still some coterie. They just simply didn't live that long. And of course, there was another in the war. There were, a lot of them were killed. But I believe we're both. I believe all human beings today are a mixture. They're a hybrid.
We're a hybrid. So that's probably why we have such a hard time just dealing with a lot of stuff in physical reality.
You got it.
And maybe that's another reason why many of us think we're just visiting. Let's take this last call. Where are you calling from? What's your first name?
Chad in Chicago.
Go ahead, Chad. You're on with Michael Tesarian.
Hey, Michael, what you were just talking about, that was my initial question. You kind of answered it. But the initial alien strain, is that the reptilian strain? And was the initial concoction, for lack of a better word, is that where the bloodline, the royal bloodline, came from? And then did we just evolve from that strain, that same strain, like you were just talking about? We're kind of all just a blend, so to speak. I'm just trying to figure out where the royal bloodline strain came from, and where the human, who are not the reptilian strain, where we came from.
Right. If you pick up the Atlantis book, or check that out, I go into this because that's very, very important. Yes, the royal bloodline, I'll get to the reptilian thing in a minute, but the royal bloodlines, because it was known that it was a bit of a mix match now, like you say, a concoction. It was very important to pick those children, pick those particular family dynastic concerns who tended to have a proclivity towards the alien. That means that they also have a chance to go towards the human, but these are families who have chosen not to do this. In other words, they're the psychopathic ones. These are the world controllers. These are the ones who are happy with the hierarchical type of situation of control. And, of course, they had to keep records because they need to make sure that they intermarry correctly so that the alien strain is in dominance. It's just the same way that you heard about the way that the Nazis would deal with eugenics and racial hygiene, and how they would selected breeding, which we do with animals, don't we? The pedigree, sure. Understanding of horses and dogs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So the bloodline that that Chad is talking about, that's what that is. It's not just a straight bloodline of people who came to this planet and have never merged with human beings. We're talking about human beings here. We're talking about people who are actually humanoid. Homo Atlantis. Like I said, I don't rule out that there's not a totally pure-blooded alien strain on this planet. David Icke seems to believe that there is. I have just not, my research is it's not corroborated, but you can't rule it out. Now, getting to the thing about reptilians, where I come in with that is I do believe they exist, but I believe that they were another level of experimentation. In this experimentation, there could have been endless amount of different experimentation. In the Atlantis book and DVD, I go into that I believe that some of the creatures of mythology, like the centaur and the siren and the unicorn and all of this kind of thing that we have in mythology, the dragon beings, I believe that is absolutely in-your-face evidence that there was genetic hybridization going on. The Greek legends are filled with it. They certainly, the Celtic legends, Jesus. When you get into the Irish thing, I mean, you're talking about full-blown, hybrid creatures that were half animal, half human. I mean, it's right there in the legends. And as I said in the beginning, that was all taken for fiction. But wait a minute, we can look back at those legends and now glean some greater sense out of it. But the reptilian, as been explained, I believe was another program of experimentation in which alien DNA was crossed with reptilian DNA, earth reptile, earth fauna, maybe not just the reptile, but other animals as well, and no human DNA involvement at all.
Wow, that's pretty wild. So,
that's pretty wild. Yeah. So that's the only little bit of a difference. That's the only sort of fine-tuning that I would have with the reptilian question. I don't think any human DNA is involved at all. But here's the thing. Because the alien DNA, the alien looks humanoid. I mean, you could if one of these aliens I'm talking about, that's the Nephilim, were standing in the room, you probably couldn't tell. So they're humanoid. So even when you cross their DNA with another form, that form will look humanoid, but it's not human.
And so you're saying that you believe then that the people, the controllers, that they've used this kind of hybridization to keep this alien DNA more pure within their families. So when you go back and you find out a lot of these families in the royal family and the Bushes and all that, they go back, for a long time.
Yeah, there's something going on
so
there. There's definitely evidence. It's not from us. This is from official documents that there is a bloodline. Believe me, for a start, this is their own terminology. They're the ones who talk about the bloodline. They're the ones who walk on the red carpet. They're the ones who talked about the blue blood. They're the ones who intermarried to the point where they were almost becoming imbecilic.
Oh, really?
Don't we know that certain inbreeding also can have some,
Sure.
If it's not. So, but that's evidence, isn't it, that they're completely obsessed with it. So they're the one. We didn't come up with these ideas. This is their own lineage of how they intermarry with the families and intermarry. And of course, they have many aspects of this, how they do this. They also have unofficial marriages you don't know about, where royal men will seed lots of other women who are just would be put before us as the girl next door or people in society, and then they secretly have these family members who can then be put in charge of the world order, you see, in the banks, in the schools, in the colleges, and we suddenly, remember you asked earlier on about why nothing ever changes with these people? Anybody break the chains of control? Well, why would they do that? If you might think they're called Smith and Jones or Tom, Dick, and Harry. How do we not know that the head of the World Bank and the head of this government and the head of that nation and the head of this think tank or the head of this particular... a group or this religion, how do we know that these Smiths and Joneses are not behind the scenes completely in the same bloodline as the people that are at the top of the pyramid of control? This is starting to leak out now, because even the Obamas, and certainly even the Cheneys and the Bushes, you see, the whistle has been blown that these people are directly linked to the Queen of England, directly linked to Prince Charles, directly linked to Charlemagne and to Constantine and to Edward I, Longshanks. This is unbelievable.
So you're talking bloodline
the
here.
The bloodline.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely the bloodline. That doesn't mean that automatically, just because somebody has a royal connection, that they're evil or anything like that. But it just is, again, a subject that needs to be looked at and go, it's another interesting piece of the puzzle to say, hang on here. Let's get any delusion out of our minds that if America is thinking to itself, if Americans are thinking that you got a republic there or you got some sort of democracy, well, you can wake up from that delusion, because it's an aristocracy is what you've got, and it's the same old royal concerns. They're just not wearing crowns on their heads and wearing silk slippers. They're maybe wearing, you know, the suit and tie, but these people have no allegiance to America. They work for the Council on Foreign Relations, for the Trilateral Commission, for these various royal institutes. All of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission are basically a wing, not just of Cecil Rhodes's oligarchical round table, but they're actually physically wings. People can study this. They're legally part of the Royal Institute of International Affairs.
Thanks for the call, Chad. So I'm going to wrap it with that, but I have to ask you is, I grapple with the idea that they have the banks and they have the military and they own the money and the money supply and all the fiat currencies, and they've really kind of, they're running things ostensibly right now. What else do they want? I mean, we go to work and we work for these dollars, and they dilute the dollars and dilute the euros and whatever else they do. They really are, you know, they got a pretty good thing going. What else would they possibly want? What is their motive?
Well, this is a huge, you know, almost every question you've asked is colossally important. And this one is a great one to end on, because it's so important. Of course, if we look at let me give you a description of a pyramid. A pyramid has four sides.
Mm-hmm.
But just like a Rubik's Cube, no matter what way you turn it, only three are visible.
Okay.
No matter how you walk around a pyramid, you're going to be stuck with the fact, unless you have a helicopter and let's cut out all that type of technology. If you're on foot, then no matter what you do, you're barely going to see two sides of it. And maybe if you really crane your neck, you'll get to see three sides of a pyramid, but you're always going to have a fourth in shadow. And that shadow, that hidden part, is this whole, what's it all about? What on earth is going on? And my look at it is that it's the servant-slave dynamic, master-slave dynamic. They needed a human race to work for them. All of their problems arose because the human being simply wouldn't serve them. So I don't care if you're talking about 13,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago. My reading of the thing is that the problem was that they crossed their DNA with a person, with a creature, that just is not a very good servant, period. they're more rebellious.
They came to the wrong planet, didn't they?
They came to the wrong planet, and it's like, you know, it's like Shakespeare's Tempest. You've either got an Ariel or you've got a Caliban, but neither of these guys are going to be good servants to you. So what the situation is that's why they went for the reptilian. They crossed their DNA with the reptilians in order to create a being that would just be completely mindlessly a servant with no human DNA at all, and it's argumentable about whether or not they got their perfect servant there. I think they did. But then, okay, let's fast forward up to where we are now and to your question. The same thing applies. Part of their agenda is to make sure that the human slave remains a slave and doesn't wake up. That's the first thing. So they have they've scaled up, haven't they? They've amped up their whole process of surveillance and control, and with the medications and the fluoride that you were talking about earlier, and the all of that, to keep the human slave in a state of servitude, because they know that if taking off the datura, the zombie stops being a zombie and is restored to normality again. But more specifically, there's something incredible going on there on that other side of the pyramid that we don't see. And that's the agenda. Where are they heading? What are they're doing? There's many levels to this. One is to do with technology, in which they want to build a technology that they can, again, become off-world beings. That's what the space program and what SDI was all about, is the ability that once they came to this planet, and they're still part of their DNA that wants to leave, you know, and roam the skies as their forefathers once did. So here they need to build and build and build the technology down through the centuries so that they get the technology again to be able to do that, to have the ability to leave the planet and travel in space. That's one aspect. The second is that there's a ritualistic element also that's very sinister that's part of this. And that is that the human being's servitude that we've been discussing is not just simply a robotic remote control type of servitude in which you perform functions for these, you know, like you were describing about pushing the wheel for them and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a more sinister ritualistic element in this, which I think is very occult, and it has to do with the nature of energy. It has the energy of blood, the energy of consciousness, you see. So there's also a sort of sacrificial aspect. This is where the wars come in, and I discussed this in the Atlantis book. This is where some of the ritual murders come in. There's a whole other aspect of this that, again, luckily has started to come to light through the work of Ted Gunderson and others and many other writers who've been trying to talk about this kind of thing. So there's that also to take on board. And then, inevitably, to finish answering your question, is like, what is their plan for tomorrow? Where are they heading? Is partly the technology they want to enhance? Is partly the dumbing down of the people, their slaves, that they want to keep, you know, enslaved? But you see, even these individuals, it's very important for them to keep a world in a state of disorder. So when they're using terms like New World Order and police state, those are just talismanic words to give you the impression that order is really what's on their mind. These are psychopaths. These are megalomaniacs. Order has nothing to do with it, because order being the true order is nature's order, is God's order. These people are the most disorderly, disharmonious creatures that you could ever want to imagine. It's only the facade of emotion. It's only the facade of control that interests them. Really, inside their psyche, they're very, very, very disassociated kinds of individuals. And that's why you see, when you open the door and you look out the window, is the climate of chaos in the world. It's because that's what these people really breed. The rest is just propaganda and words. Wherever these people go, they leave death and darkness behind them. That's the kind of creatures they are. And that's what we're trying to combat, you see. So it's partly that to understand the nature of the psychopath, you're not understanding a sane person. So don't expect sane behavior, you see. So they may talk in terms through the loudspeaker. Uh-huh. They talk about the perfect utopia, the perfect global village, a crime-free, stable, stronger, all of this, you know, what we call malarkey. That's all it is. That's just the stuff to lull the people into a sense of, you know, total control.
Boy, and it's
ultimately... Ultimately, well, they're about devastation, wreck, and ruin, just like all the colonialists of the past have been, about mass murder, genocide, confiscation, and extortion. That's what they're about.
And I'm a political atheist, but I could say, in your host's eyes, whatever, for what it's worth, it seems like Mr. Obama is like the perfect person, you know, for this time, for them. This is like...
Sure. You can take the blood-soaked, bone-filled road to hell, meaning to the global village, to world control, or you can take the scenic route. It's up to you. They give you a choice.
There you go.
The Pied Piper can play more than one tune on his pipe, but the rat is neither here nor there. The goal is the end. The goal is the edge of the cliff, but the tune that might be played. Did you know that the latest story is that now they're projecting gigantic images of Obama in various schools in the same way that Hitler's image was Nazi Germany?
What do you mean, on screens and on the walls and stuff?
Yeah, on the walls. Uh-huh. In fact, it was the kids that reported it. There's an article I have now on the forum. The kids are reporting they're coming in to finding giant projections of
that guy.
Oh, he's the Big Brother's new messiah. You know, it's like something out of George Orwell's, 1984. He's going to be, you know, 600 times life size, so that, you know, everyone's looking up to the little man, you know.
So I guess, Michael, the best we can do is do what we're doing, all of us, and to get more aware of what's going on, and to help our neighbors all we can. I mean, what else can we do, right? Take care of ourselves.
I would say that's it. This has to be a work of great passion and an adventure, not out of stress, not out of crisis. Mm-hmm. Think this has to be out of solution, think out of a genuine, you know, moral interest, and never forgetting that it's rooted in the psychology of all human beings. You know, just like you would not tolerate any kind of burglar or any kind of violation to your own property, so the world is our property, and we need to defend it against the tyrants who want to take away freedom, justice, and liberty.
Michael Tesarian, you are just a joy to spend time with. We've had a lovely evening, and thanks for staying up, and I know it's very early in the morning there in Europe. It is Michael Tesarian, TSARION.com, MichaelTesarian.com, and you have all your stuff on there, right, Michael? The books, the forum, the links,
sure.
Everything right there. Huh?
Yeah, MichaelTesarian.com is a navigation page to all the different sites and all the different articles and free web streams and all the rest of it we've got up there. So, again, you know.
And if folks are going to go out and buy one book or one CD, which one should they start with?
Start with the latest one that we did, architectsofcontrol.com.
Architectsofcontrol.com. And that'll dig into the world of Michael Tesarian and the rest of the world. Michael, have a very pleasant morning and sleep tight. And we hope to see you soon. If there's anything we can do, let us know and we'll pass on this link to you in the next day or so you can get it up.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been wonderful to speak with you. Thank you very much for the time.
It's our pleasure, sir. Good morning. Good night. Good night. Michael Tesarian. Lovely man, eh? Really great fun. Well, thanks for hanging out all this time. We had a good time. We will talk to you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And it's Open Phone Friday, and it's great fun. We really kind of wrap up the week, talk about some of the interviews, talk about a lot of health things, answer questions about your health. And it starts at 7 o'clock, goes for 2 hours tomorrow, 7 p.m. Central Time. So come by and call in and have some fun. I love you all very much. And let's keep working on taking care of each other. And we're doing fine. This is just where we need to be. See you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. My name is Patrick Timpone. Take care.
Know the Source on One Radio Network.